The Pelagian controversy. Pelagian. P-E-L-A.
Is it M? Is it faster?
Hmm?
Is it A, M?
We're in G, aren't we?
We're in G, yeah.
G. The Pelagian. This was an anthropological controversy which embraced the whole realm of doctrine. Anthro meaning man. Pelagical means study. Anthropos. Anthropos is Greek for man. Anthropological, study of man. So his will, man's fall, the nature of man, and how man is saved. The matter boils down, quote, to the question whether redemption is chiefly the work of God or of man, whether man needs to be born again or merely improved. The soul of the Pelagian system is human freedom. The soul of the Augustinian is divine grace. There were two opposing values. Pelagius really taught that there was a divine spark in us, that we just needed to be helped. We didn't need to be saved. Augustine taught that we were depraved and we needed God to step in with grace. Pelagius, he was a monk, about 350 AD, probably living in Wales. He's described as a mild, quiet man of clear intellect. He was learned and of spotless character, they say. He may best be described as the exact opposite in temperament to Augustine. The two were bound to clash. He was expelled from Britain, came to Rome about 409, bringing his peculiar doctrines with him. Celestius was a Roman convert of Pelagius who became the intellectual mouthpiece of the Pelagian teachings. Now here it is outlined. The Antiochian school of thought. Pelagius was a student of Eastern theology and was in no doubt influenced by his weakness in doctrines of sin and salvation. Eastern theology held to a synergism in salvation, means a merging of concepts, man cooperating with God. Some of the notable teachings of Pelagian, as espoused by Celestius, were Adam was created mortal and would have died regardless of whether he sinned or not. That's what the teaching was. Adam's fall injured only himself, not the entire human race. All children are born in the same condition as Adam before the fall. Is that true? Not at all. But men either die as a consequence of Adam's sin, man neither die as a consequence of Adam's sin, nor rise again as a consequence of Christ's resurrection. It's up to you. Unbaptized children, as well as others, are saved. And to the Catholics, that was the big heresy, okay? Just understand, Catholics figure some things are bad. Obviously, we don't have a problem with unbaptized children, but they did. The law, as well as the gospel, leads to the kingdom of God. Even before Christ, there were sinful men, obviously, but this is what he taught. All men, like Adam, were created neutral with no evil tendencies. Hey, sounds like a politician. We're all good. We just need some help. We need better environments. We need better funding. We need better this, and we'll all come out better. Sin is only an act of the will. It's not sin in you. It's what you choose to do. Now, I agree, sin is what you choose to do, but it's because I want to do it. It's in me. In fact, man may not sin at all if he so chooses. And I've heard enough, and again, I don't mean to be harping on charismatic preachers, but I've heard enough false doctrine to tell you that there are some major doctrinal problems with people like, not just Benny Hinn. Benny Hinn is like he's like in primary school compared to Kenneth Hagin and Kenneth Copeland and some of the other charlatans, I would be very strong, who actually say that God could have chosen anybody to be the Messiah. If any man would be sold out enough to God, God could use them. They teach this idea that you can stay sinless. And that's what's this woman preacher that everybody loves nowadays?
Myers.
Joyce Myers. And Joyce Myers teaches that. And now, Joyce Myers got a lot of good doctrine. She's probably a better preacher than most men. But she has no right preaching because the Bible forbids it. But she has two or three really big problems. And one of them is she says that a Christian can go for long extended periods of time without sinning. And I say, you don't have to sin. But once you conquer one sin, another pop up. Once you get that thing under the blood, another one will pop up. You're never going to go without sinning. You'll never do. You'll always sin at some stage, some way, thought selfish. you'll respond not like Christ. I'm constantly trying to become more like Christ, but sin is in me. I can't stop breathing. And I can't stop naturally sinning without a sin of ignorance. Even if I ignorantly sin, I have to confess that. When I find out, ooh, I did wrong. But people get this idea that, no, the cross removed the power of sin from you. You are free from the power of sin. That's a lie. I'm free from the penalty of sin. I am constantly enabled to be free on a moment-by-moment basis from the power of sin. One day I'll be free from the presence of sin. But don't you teach that Christians can go for extended periods of time. There are people who actually, I haven't sinned in 3 years. They just sinned. They just lied. Okay? Now, I don't want to give anybody comfort in sin saying, well, I guess I'll live in sin. There's a difference between living in sin and sinning. Okay? There is a big, big debate among the charismatics over this concept, and I already settled it, but it comes even into Christians, where when we're trying to help people with addictions, we try to tell them, you can be free. But don't you get the idea that once you put that drink down, that you no longer sin? That drink's not your only sin. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, somebody had a hand up. Yes, sir.
The principles in the Old Testament, didn't they have to offer up sacrifices for unknown sins?
That's right. That's right.
So that we do commit sin, we may not realize it, but
Amen.
We do commit sin.
That's right. And that's the point. But people get the idea that Romans 6 teaches we are no longer a sinner. Yet Romans 7 says very clearly, woe unto me, the wretched man that I am. And the only way Paul counters that, it says, I am a wretched man, I am a sinner, I am sold under sin. Well, I'll just stay crucified. I am crucified. That's the only way to stay. You just have to keep bringing another blood, keep walking in the light, keep getting cleansed, keep waking up, being washed by the Word, or else I wouldn't need the Bible anymore. I wouldn't need prayer anymore. I'm not sinning. Okay? Big thing, right? Pelagius opened up a huge debate. Jay, the universal fact of sin is a result of poor education. Oh, boy, that sounds very politically profitable. It comes from bad examples and established habits. Man is not dependent on the grace of God for salvation. He shouldn't be, though he is helped by it in overcoming evil. That's what Pelagian taught. Pelagius taught the history of the controversy. The teachings of Pelagianism were brought to Rome by Pelagius himself, then later by North Africa, by Celestius, and then Palestine by Pelagius when he was kicked out of Rome. The condemnation of Pelagianism. The fluctuating fortunes of Pelagianism are shown as follows. I don't know if I want to go through all of these things. Just skip all that. That just goes through some of the history, how he was hounded and hunted. The semi-Pelagian reaction. Some people took parts of what he believed. Now, why would Pelagian be... I'll ask John. John, why was Pelagius popular? Why was his teachings popular? Well, this was... Okay, all right. Okay, good. That's what I want you to do. Get in your mind. This is post-325. This is the beginning of the Catholic Church state. Okay? So, you have... The mindset was one doctrine fits all. And it's a Catholic doctrine. It's not biblical. And why would people jump and run, you say, because it was against the flow? Not necessarily. That's a modern invention where everybody wants to go against the flow. Usually, 50 years ago, everybody just wanted to get along. Why would this appeal to people and they would be willing to throw away Catholic doctrine, which was being established with the Nicene Creeds, with all the councils?
Okay, that they're okay.
Okay, you're actually going somewhere. All right, well, you're on to something, but I want to boil it down even simpler.
You don't need God.
Good. I'm okay. Somebody wrote a book about the same time as Benjamin Spock, wrote, I'm okay, you're okay. No matter if you're homosexual, you're okay. If you're they didn't go so far as pedophilia and other things, but they just said, listen, it's okay. Well, who you are is who you are. Just realize you're okay. And whatever I am, I'm okay. Oh, that appealed. Countless, tens of millions of copies were sold in the first year. Everybody read it because it appealed to the flesh. It made me feel better about myself. You know how you get saved? All of a sudden you lift up Christ and you come in low and you feel like I need to flee from the wrath to come. I'm in trouble with God. That's how you get saved. So, semi-Pelagian reaction is, we're going to pick and choose and collect and believe in some of this, what he believed. It was an attempt to find middle ground between Augustinianism and Pelagianism. The doctrine of what was later to be called semi-Pelagianism was formulated in Marseille, France, by John Cassian. A comparison to the three positions are as follows. Pelagianism says man is well, and man, if he has a problem, he can save himself. Augustinianism says man is dead, grace alone saves man. Now, Augustinian becomes what? Calvinism. Augustinianism becomes Calvinism, becomes it's all of God, none of men. And that's a reaction to Pelagius. Augustine should have stayed with the Bible, but instead he was constantly fighting Pelagius. So he came and he backed himself in a corner and he says, there is nothing in us that can save ourselves. Nothing at all. God has to do all the saving. Sounds good, doesn't it? But what am I doing believing then? Why does the Bible say repent, believe the gospel? Why does the Bible say come unto me, all you that labor heavy laden? Talking to lost people. You understand? So there were two extremes. The semi-Pelagianism says, well, man is sick. Man initiates and God completes salvation. Wrong. Who initiates salvation, Lisa? I have to respond, don't I? But God is what initiates. Semi-Pelagian says, well, just start seeking God and then God can be found. Dangerous. That's a dangerous truth, isn't it? Because they can say, seek him at our church. Seek him through the bread and the wine. Seek him through the sacraments. See, it's all you. Seek, 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 seek. Semi-Pelagianism was upheld at two synods. Everybody all of a sudden started believing these things, which wasn't necessarily bad. Ulfilas, he was known as the Little Wolf. 311 to 380, his early life, his father was a Cappadocian monk, or Cappadocian priest, married. His mother was a Goth. She was, she had been a barbarian. And he was a slave to the Goths. He was taken hostage to Constantinople. He stayed there 10 years, and there he got saved. He was ordained by Eusebius, and he was apostle to the Goths. It's amazing. Patrick, he gets taken into slavery, and then he becomes the apostle to those people that had him in slavery. Ulfilas, the same thing. Successes in his ministry, and he was a good guy. He set up Gothic as a written language. The barbarians didn't write anything.
You should be wrong today. You're going to Bond Street.
Yeah, those Goths. Amen. But he wrote down Gothic. He translated the Bible. It's called the Old Gothic Bible, and it agrees with our King James Bible. And all the older, and it's older than all other manuscripts. Earl Carnes, that's our book here, points out that because the Goths were so warlike, he felt justified in not translating the books of Kings and Samuels into the language, which was kind of funny. He translated the entire Bible, but he left out Kings and Chronicles. You know why? Because a lot of war in there. He said, I don't want to encourage them to fight. He had a good heart. So, Kings and Samuel. His Bible spread all over Germany and South Russia. It was called the Silver Bible because silver letter on purple ground. I forget why that was.
So he took from the Bible, sorry, either.
He took two Bibles. He just did. He refused to include 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Samuel. Yeah, because of all the fighting. It's kind of funny. Joshua has a lot of fighting in it. I don't know, but just what the history has. He was the first of a long line of illustrious missionaries who have made significant contributions to linguistics and to literature, as well as to the dissemination or the publishing of the scriptures. He died in Constantinople during his last visit. Martin, the Bishop of Tours, he was a missionary to Gaul. Again, you're in the 300s, and there are people. These are people that we know about. These aren't the unknowns who go into all the world. But here's a guy, Martin. He was Hungarian born. His parents were unsaved. He was a former soldier, and he used military methods. He led armies to destroy idols and pagan temples. He died at 80 years of age with the words, "Lord, if I am still needed for thy people, I would not draw back from the work." He was kind of rough. He was a rough cut. And I remember a guy named Christmas Evans. I read his biography. And right after he got saved in a revival. They didn't have a preacher in that town where he was for 10 years. And this preacher comes in and starts preaching night after night after night after night. Somebody convinced him to come in. And he comes in. To make a long story short, he gets saved. And he asks the preacher, "What do I do now?" He says, "Go get somebody else and get them saved." So he goes back. The only life he ever lived was in the pub. He had no wife. He had no kids. He went back in. This was back in the 1870s. And he went back in. He went in the saloon. He picked on the biggest guy. He was already a big guy. And he just took that guy by the throat, threw him down on the ground, put his fist in his face. "You going to get saved?" That's how he started his evangelistic campaign. But he became a great evangelist.
Did it work?
It worked, man. There were people coming that every night to that man because he's dragging them, because he's going to kill them if they didn't come. But that's how I think of Martin. Diodorus, he was the bishop of Antioch. He became the bishop of Tarsus. He taught literal exegesis of the Bible, take it literally, which was unusual. And he was the teacher of a great teacher, a future preacher named Chrysostom. John Chrysostom. He's called the golden-mouthed preacher. Born in Antioch, good place to be born from because of its influence from the Bible. He was baptized, studied at Antioch. He lived as a hermit or as a monk. He was afraid of the world. He saw the sin of the world and he ran. He says, I can't handle women. I can't handle the sin that's in the marketplace. And he ran. And some of these guys, you say, oh, that's stupid. That's God still uses stupid things that we do. He returns to Antioch. He was made a deacon and ordained at Antioch. And he got a great reputation as a preacher for 12 years. And he preached the Bible literally and exegetically. What does that mean? Yeah, to exegete means to explain every verse. He just went through and he just taught through the Bible. He was forced to become the bishop of Constantinople. He fought with a guy named Theophilus, the bishop of Alexandria, which we've seen in the past. He fought over Origen's teaching. Origen was a heretic, and he constantly argued, saying, no, he's wrong, because he was always allegorical. He got John condemned and deposed briefly. I don't remember who that John is. He fought with the empress of the day. He argued with her, and he was banished, who banished him from Cocusus, Armenia, and he died on a forced march to Pityus. The idea is some of these guys didn't live illustrious lives, but they were lights in their area, and these guys were literalists when it came to the Bible. Jovinius, he was the Protestant of his time. He was a well-educated monk. He believed that all sins are equal. That's a good thing. He taught, oh yeah, you only told a white lie, it's still a lie. He believed salvation by grace. He believed in eternal security of the believer. He taught the equality of, it shouldn't say believers, it should be believers, sorry about that. I don't understand. Sometimes my spelling checker works, but on some of my large documents, it Microsoft is not perfect. Fasting did not nut. Come on. Fasting did not make someone spiritual. He just taught that you fast because you're trying to get an answer. It doesn't make you more spiritual.
So are these guys all Catholics?
These were Catholics who were trying to go according to the Bible and not just stay with the Catholic system.
Right.
Again, most of our history is written by the Catholics. And so you're going to find out, Martin, if you're going to have a Reformation, you're going to have to some Catholics to get a hold of a Bible, because the Anabaptists on the sidelines, they're hunted, they have no jobs, they can't own property, and so their works are marginalized. If you're going to have a Reformation, it has to come from God raising up somebody like a Martin Luther. Okay. Under persecution, he and his followers moved to northern Italy, and Jovinius, he helps start a bunch of Arnalists, Petrobrusians, and Henricians, which we will study in the next few weeks. M. Patrick.
I thought he was Welsh.
No, southern Scotland. I have. Who says Wales? I've seen it for Wales, but most of the thing is Scotland. Most of the thing is southern Scotland, where he's from. His grandfather, Apotheus, was a married priest, which is, you just got to get in your head. It wasn't until the 12th century that priests were forbidden to be married. His father, Calpurnius, was a minor noble and a deacon in the church. He had 5 sisters, 1 brother. His full name was Magnus Secundus Patricius. We just call him Patrick. He, he was a free-born Roman citizen. His life as a slave was. He was captured by Irish raiders and made a slave at 16 years of age. He worked as a shepherd, saved while working the sheep. You know, he got saved on his own. Anybody ever read his confession? You ought to read his confession. He said, God, open my eyes. I'm out there. Whatever his daddy and his grandfather taught him finally came home to him. The penny dropped. Mm-hmm. He's out there in slavery. He's beaten. He's in the weather. He's barefoot. He's running out after sheep. He has no hope. And God says, you ready? Ready to trust me? And he turns to Christ. He realized how much a sinner he was. He doesn't blame anybody. He says, my sin. God humbled me. And that's when he got saved at 16 years old. And he got saved 6 years later. He became a missionary in 432 AD. The Irish of the 5th century were a gay, life-loving people. I'm quoting from a thing called The Steadfast Man about Patrick. A gay, life-loving people who could be bemused by a beautiful woman, a fine horse, the exquisite action of a running deer, or the death of a brave man pierced by a multitude of swords, but still resolutely facing the enemy, and one who would be buried with all his weapons standing up and still facing toward the foe. They loved it. They would stand up, an Irishman, in the grave. They were vital, viral, often brutal. They slaughtered one another gaily in sectional war, stole one another's cattle and women, drank, and feasted. Wore fine clothes and magnificent gold bracelets. We went to the museum in Scotland and saw all the Celtic bracelets and pendants there in Scotland. But Ireland's the same. You go to the Natural History up here in History of Ireland on is it Marion Avenue or whatever, there in Dublin. And I mean, everybody loved these pendants and they just loved gold jewelry here in the Isles. Brooches when they could afford it, and in general played the male and human devil over the beautiful green and wooded country. Their theology was simple. Nature, an object or idol worship, or rather respect for nature's great signpost to God, the sun, the moon, and stars overhead. It requires no priesthood. The Druids were never priests, but interpreters, prophets, teachers, magicians, lawyers, judges, bards, and poets. They were the keepers of the Irish soul until Patrick came along and showed them how that soul might be blended and united with that God who had created all the beauty in and about them. At least that's what he said. A lot of that is true, but we kind of know a little bit deeper. His qualifications, no record of any formal education. That's very important. He only knew the Bible. He quoted 23 New Testament and 15 Old Testament books in his two writings. When was the last time you wrote a letter and you quote 23 New Testament and 15 Old Testament books? Quote 15 passages out of 15 different books in the Old Testament. When was the last time you did that? He just knew the Bible. He probably used either the Old Latin or the Old Gothic Bible. Listen to his boldness. He was undaunted by the opposition of pagan chieftains of the Druids. Everywhere he gathered people about him in the open field and he preached Christ to them. His burning zeal and deep sincerity coupled with a kindly gentleness of manner completely won the hearts of the peasants and the nobility alike. His successes in 360 churches are said to have been started by him. 12,000 were baptized. And this is my favorite one. 3,008 preachers were ordained. A lot of them went to France. A lot of them went back to England. Some of them went to Holland. Some of them went... He's...
What is it?
360 churches, 12,000 baptized, 3,008 preachers were ordained. Was he a Catholic? Patrick's name is not found in the records of any Roman Catholic church or monastery. He had no connection with the Pope. His grandfather was a married priest, and in reliable accounts of his career, there's no reference to such Romish practices as auricular confession, that's oral confession in the ear, extreme unction, or the worship of Mary. He functioned in Ireland long before any great division of the early church, and he landed on Irish shores in 432 AD, before the Roman bishops had won universal recognition. He was a pre-papal Christian, not concerned with schisms, but was rather crude and unlettered, a great organizer of men and monks, but certainly no philosopher like the Roman Catholic Church was. Why do Catholics claim him? Well, later Roman Catholic writers have sought to make it appear that he received a commission from the Pope to evangelize the Irish. but his own writings make no mention of such a commission, and it is highly improbable that he consulted with the Pope with reference to his great wife work. Going into Ireland with a few coadjutors, about 432 he labored for co-workers. He labored for many years with wonderful zeal and success, evangelizing more or less thoroughly the whole of Ireland. He left a reputation for sanctity of life and spiritual power that entitles him to be considered one of the greatest of missionaries. How do you know that he wasn't Catholic? Up until the 9th century, none of the churches that were founded all over Ireland by Patrick and by his successors had high crosses. None of them had images. Each church had its own bishop, which was unheard of. Over in England, the Pope had lots of papal envoys who constantly ran all over Europe and England. But when they came to Ireland, you know what they wrote back? We need to evangelize these, what they call themselves. They're called, I want to say brutish Christians, but they used a different word. Not just immature.
Primitive
maybe. It was a very harsh word saying, these Christians, they don't understand how to have structure. They don't know how to have multiple layers of hierarchy. These churches have no altars. That was what they were upset about. They wrote back to the Pope saying, these, maybe it was, primitive Christians in Ireland. Well, that was Patrick's legacy. We know he wasn't Catholic, because nothing that he did matches what the Pope was doing. The old British churches were of great antiquity, originating around the close of the Apostolic Age. They say that Paul may have even skirted up to southern England before he actually got in his final imprisonment in Rome. And in the remaining, the old British churches remained in isolation from the mainstream of religious change and compromises. With the impending collapse of the Roman Empire, Britain was abandoned by its Roman garrisons, and the churches, along with the population, were soon pushed back into Wales and Western Britain by the advancing Saxons, Germans. In other words, the churches in Britain and Ireland were not like the Catholic churches of Lower Europe. Vigilantius here, he was a native of Gaul. Where was Gaul?
France.
Northern France. Ordained 390, he began a trip to visit the great men of the East. He was trying to find different great leaders to follow, and great religious leaders. Nola is shocked by the paganism that was incorporated in the church in a town called Nola. In Bethlehem, Jerome only made him hate monasticism. In Egypt, he found Origen's doctrine was only causing fighting and bickering. In northern Italy, he visits a bunch of Jovinists. How do you say that?
Jovinians.
Okay, Jovinians. Did we say, what were the Jovinians? What did we say? That we were called the early Protestants. All right, so he meets some early Protestants. He returned full of zeal to restore apostolic doctrine and practice. He had a friend in the Bishop of Toulouse. He had an enemy of Jerome, the Bible writer. His beliefs basically were generally the same as the Jovinians. He had no worship of the martyrs. Chastity is a hotbed of lust, meaning that by telling guys that you should live celibate and that you should live in as monks and things like that actually is causing more problems than helping. Said no prayers for the dead. He called monks cowards. Yes. He said, there's problems up there in that monastery and we don't even want to talk about it. That's what he was saying. He probably died in the invasion of the Vandals, another barbarian group, and followers are to follow in the early Middle Ages.
Is that the word vigilante comes from?
Maybe. Or he got that name from the Latin meaning he was very vigil. Okay. Quickly, baptism in the 4th century. I don't know how we're going to do this. This century saw the official ratification of the teaching that baptism washed away past sins. Because phenomenal changes occurred during the period of history, the meaning of baptism also had to change. For example, the fact that so many converts were not saved. They were in church, they were there, but they had never been born again. The teaching that baptism washed away all pre-baptismal sins resulted in two logical outcomes. First of all, infant baptism and clinical baptism. The babies baptize babies lest they die. And then, so you baptize babies, and if you haven't been baptized, wait until the last second before you get baptized. Why?
Do you only want it?
Yeah, and so that you don't sin after you get baptized. So it created two logical things. Quick, get them baptized in case they die, and they go to... First, they said all babies that weren't baptized went to hell. Then, in about the 6th or 7th century, they said, or maybe the 8th century, they said, oh, they go to limbo, because they haven't sinned yet. And then wait until the end. So that was the... Once you believe that baptism washes away sins, you're going to wait till the last second to get baptized. You ever notice people today, God, getting saved right now? Your teen group, you'll watch them. They'll come in and they'll sit there and they'll sit there and they'll sit there and they won't get saved. You know why? Because they don't want to give up their sins. They'll say, oh, I get saved when I'm dying or when it's the last minute. It's just the way people are. And if you move baptism out, it's the same thing. In both cases, pouring was the convenient mode. And later on began the practice of aspersion. What's aspersion? Sprinkling. Dribbling and just sprinkling. Run down here to baptism in the 5th century. The conflict between the Donatists, thank God for them, and those who held to baptismal grace saw the establishment of infant baptism by law. You ought to get a book called The Bible Makes Us Baptists. And that'll put the hair on the back of your neck straight up. Because you'll see just how rough it was for about 1,000 years during the Dark Ages when infant baptism was law. The Don...
That one about the girl, whatever she's growing up in.
Yeah, that's right. And they take her baby and they throw it in the river because she wouldn't baptize and drown the baby. She says, well, if you won't baptize it, we'll baptize them for you. It's take the baby from her, throw it right in the river, holding her back. They took people and they would take them and tie them to a stone. And they would baptize them, but not let, you know, and they would throw them into the river. And that was their mock baptism, because these were Anabaptists who said that all your baptism was fake before you got saved, and they were baptizing adults. Well, the priest would come in and says, well, let's show them how to really baptize. And they were the first, mafia, fitting a pair of concrete shoes to these. And they'd throw them in the river and just leave them there. There were people who were actually baptized in dirt. They were up to their head in they dig a hole, put them into the ground, fill up the dirt, and then they would let a charge through the street. They'd bury them in the middle of the street and let people run over them with the horse and carriage and stuff. And the people would do it because they were making a show of them. And these were Anabaptists. If you want to get mad, if you want to get angry at what a religious church state can end up doing. You read, the Bible makes us Baptists. The Donatists, North African Donatists, rejected Catholic baptism, claiming it to be no baptism at all. They rebaptized all who came into their churches from the establishment church. Did you get that? So we get some people who say, we want to join your church. And I say, yeah, let's talk about your baptism. What did you believe? How were you baptized? Do you hold any part of that baptism is part of your saving faith? If you're a Mormon and you were baptized as a Mormon, guess what I'm going to do to you when you get saved and you want to come to church? I don't care if you've been baptized 15 times, Mormon, Jehovah's Witness, Catholic, Protestant, I'm going to baptize you again after you've been truly born again. Amen? Because that's what we do. The Donatist controversy was a conflict between separatism and Catholicism, between ecclesiastical purism and ecclesiastical eclecticism. I love all these theological terms. It just means, do you just have a whole bunch of things put together, or do you just stay pure with the doctrine? Between the idea of the church as an exclusive community of regenerate saints, I agree to that, and the idea of the church as the general Christendom of state and people. That's how come people don't like the universal church concept. Do you know what the universal church is, Lisa? Okay. Barry?
It's like all the people.
Are part of the church. Now that's a dangerous saying because that was what the Catholics taught. That if you were a Catholic, you're part of the church. You didn't have to even choose because your parents chose for you and you're not part of the... And we reject that concept of the universal church. But the Bible does say that when you are born again, you're part of his body, which is the church. But boy, you're no good if you're not a member of a local church. So we're local church, but we understand the concept, the biblical concept of the universal church. But you can understand why some Baptists hate the concept of the local, of the universal church because of the, of this time period, the abuse to it. It revolved around the doctrine of the essence of the Christian church, which is the doctrine of holiness. How, now, some of the most significant events, let's skip down to the first five-century period. All right, you saw a gradual change from a level biblical democracy in the local church to where it became a preacher church form of government, where the preacher did all the decisions. There was a change from salvation by grace to baptismal salvation. There's a change from believer's baptism to now infant baptism. You saw, you should have noticed the hierarchy was organized, and it married with the church and state. The seat of the empire changed from Rome to Constantinople. Infant baptism was established by law and made compulsory. If Dan, you may not understand it, but say if you came to Ireland as a missionary 40 years ago, and you had your kids with you. I know 40 years ago you weren't married, maybe. But say you had your kids with you. Your kids could not go to school if they weren't baptized. You had to either be baptized Catholic or Protestant. And if you weren't baptized, man, there was all kinds of consternation. Now that thing's been adjusted, but Ireland, same thing, England or whatever, you just did not baptize children. It just was ingrained in everybody for the last 1,200 years. That's the effect of it. We don't even think about it now because it's barely a reaction. Christians in these five centuries begin to persecute Christians, and the Dark Ages begin about 426. We'll talk about that next week. The sword and the torch, rather than the gospel, became the power of God and salvation. How are people becoming Christian? By a sword, by fear. All semblance of religious liberty dies and is buried and remains buried for the next several centuries. Local New Testament churches, by whatever name they are called, are hunted and hounded to the utmost limit of the new Catholic temporal power. Remnants scatter all over the world, and they're finding uncertain hiding places in forests and mountains, valleys and dens and caves in the earth. All right. That's the end of that section. Any questions? As we pick up speed now we're going to start to learn about the Paulicians and the Arnaldists and the Waldensians. Now you get out of, it's kind of like coming out of a dark tunnel. All of a sudden, there's some lights. Now, we've already read some lights. Patrick, these guys, at incredible odds, are preaching the gospel, starting churches, but the pressure was unbelievable. Now something happens. I can't tell you. I don't know if it's just because they just, records weren't kept of these, of the first, second, third, fourth century. I mean, how would you know of the Apostle Paul if it weren't for the Bible? He was a criminal. How would you know about, Peter and these guys if it weren't for the Bible? Because they eradicate the politicians don't want to honor this guy. He's not one of them. That's right. So if you're going to find out about some of these lives, it's just amazing that we get little bits and tidbits. But now we're going to see what led up to Martin Luther, what led up to John Wycliffe, what led up to William Tyndale, what burned in their heart, why they were so passionate. Let's take a break. 5 minutes.